Hello, it's the last Conversations for 2015, and this week we've been remembering some of our most popular conversations from the year. And there is no better way to end the week and our year than with some stories of fun, outrageous falsehoods, and stark fear. Late last year, we held a special live Conversations event at the Giant Dwarf Theatre in Sydney. We invited some former guests to tell some true stories on stage, stories on the theme of faking it. All of us have at some stage pretended to be something that we're not, either by inflating something good or downplaying something bad or by simply fabricating some monstrously untrue thing just for fun. Our storytellers opened their hearts and revealed the filthy, outrageous untruths of their deep, dark pasts. We've got stories of gangsters and spies and love and childbirth, fake childbirth, that is, if such a thing is even possible, and as you'll find out, it is. Our first storyteller is Jill Hicks. Jill is a peace activist and the founder of the Mad for Peace organisation. This all came about after Jill lost both her legs in a bomb attack on the London Tube. Jill came on the program in 2012, and it's still one of our most popular conversations. When we told Jill that the theme of the event was faking it, Jill said, "No, I've got a story about faking it."
I am probably the most fake person here. In fact, 30% of me is completely inanimate, not real. It's been made to order, prosthetic. Nothing more than a unique mixture of titanium, hydraulics, and plastic. Now, being fake wasn't a choice I made, but I'm used to it, because being fake enables me to act normal. Now, my first understanding of how important being normal is was when I was in hospital and the psych team came to visit me during a usual ward round. This was an understandable visit given what I'd been through and witnessed in the aftermath of a suicide bombing. Now, after their third visit, I managed to convince them that my euphoria was nothing at all to be worried about. That, yes, I knew I'd been in a bomb blast. Yes, I know I don't have legs, but I was alive, wonderfully, gloriously alive, and I couldn't hide or disguise my absolute gratitude. Being happy, acknowledging the fragility of life, was and is pivotal to my everyday. To feel anything, pain and pleasure, what a privilege that is. Now, I often like to be loud and comical and quite the exhibitionist, which is all rather pretty strange stuff for someone who's inherently very shy and very private. Now, the very loud, gregarious Jill often gets me into trouble. There was a day when I convinced a very lovely fellow amputee at my London rehab centre that I had a prosthetic head. Now, the very lovely Morris was 92 years old, and he had recently lost a leg due to illness. And during our long day sessions, I would run around and I'd look after Morris and I would get his coffee and his biscuits and we'd have a chat about the weather, as one does. And one day I was there and my legs were being reconditioned. So I was walking on two exposed poles. Morris was completely in shock because he didn't know that I was actually an amputee. And he said, "Oh, my dear, you have both gone. I didn't know. And yet you get my coffee and you walk around. Oh, aren't you marvellous?" Now, as Morris was finishing the word marvellous, something very strange was rising up in me. And I was just overcome with this sense of a need to play. And so I looked at Morris with a very straight face and I said in response, "Yes, yes, 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 and a prosthetic head too." Expecting him to laugh. But he didn't. so I continued. It's amazing what they can do these days. I even got a choice between blonde and brunette. And look, you can just see where it joins the neck. I mean, it's not great, but it's pretty good for the public health care service. Morris was in awe. And as his carer came to collect him, he couldn't wait to tell her all about me. And then once he got to the reception desk, he excitedly shared with the team that he had just met the most incredible woman. What was her name? She has two prosthetic legs and a head. Amazing. She was talking to me just like normal. Amazing. You people are gods with the work that you do. Off he went in the wheelchair. Now, the team, of course, were very puzzled by what Morris was saying. They then apparently looked at Morris and said, "Was this girl's name Jill by any chance?" They were on to me. I often thought, how did they know it was me? You know, it's funny that sometimes I actually don't appear disabled enough. When I'm standing in a train or a bus and no one can actually see that I'm struggling and offer to give up a seat. So some days it actually makes me want to take off my legs and wave them in the air and scream, "I have no legs! It's really uncomfortable trying to stand and balance in moving, swaying transport. Please give me a seat." But of course, I don't do that. I stand and I balance and I smile through the discomfort because faking it is actually very real for me. Thank you.
Jill Hicks is the founder of Mad for Peace. She's received an MBE for her peace work and she's the 2015 South Australian of the Year. Now, we're all pretty happy about that around here. The next speaker was Jack the Insider. Jack the Insider is an author and blogger. He writes about politics and sport, but he reserves a special soft place in his heart for Australian true crime stories. Jack co-wrote the book Shallow Graves, and he was the producer and writer of the TV series Tough Nuts, Australia's Hardest Criminals. And Jack began with a shocking declaration.
Good people, it is my solemn duty to report that I am a fake. Intrinsically bogus. I've been very warmly introduced as Jack the Insider, but I am neither Jack nor an insider. My real name is Peter, and I sit in a darkened room most of the time, almost surgically attached to the internet, thumping out columns that Jared Henderson does not approve of. I can go for days on end without talking to anyone even remotely influential, unless you count cartoonists. And I don't. On a wall in that darkened room hangs Bill Leake's portrait of John Frederick Chow Hayes, a Sydney crim who routinely caused mayhem around these parts for the best part of four decades, standing over other villains, bashing and shooting his way to the top of the Sydney crime scene. In his twilight years, Chow put his hand up for five murders, including one he had been acquitted for. He was the last man sentenced to hang in New South Wales for the audacious murder of Bobby Lee in 1951. Chow shot the Tomo's 2-up bouncer in front of a packed room in an old drag act club in Market Street. Bobby Lee's last words provide an intriguing insight into his personal delusion. "You're not going to shoot me here in front of all these people," he told Chow. But Bobby Lee wasn't just wrong. He was wrong five times. Now, given Chow's reputation, it was unsurprising that none of the 80 or so patrons at the drag club came forward to assist police with their inquiries. But ultimately, Chow was convicted and sentenced to hang. His death sentence was commuted when the New South Wales Labor government struck the death penalty off the books in 1956. Chow never voted in his life, but after that, he developed an understandable affinity towards the Labor Party. I've long become accustomed to Chow's black-eyed, disapproving look staring back at me as so beautifully captured by Leake, but I never met the man. Rather, the portrait hangs there in some bizarre tribute to some of the things I do when I emerge from my darkened room. The genre is known as true crime, and I have written and made television shows about it. Now, true crime is a bit of a misnomer, to be honest. It does relate to crime and criminals, of course, but it is rarely true and more often apocryphal. For rather obvious reasons, most gangsters are not going to confess to murder to a television producer over a beer in a seedy pub. But some of the minutiae I've compiled over the years provide some interesting, if arcane, knowledge. For example, I can explain that little bump on the tarmac at Sydney's domestic airport east-west runway. You may have experienced it yourself in your travels, just a little almost discernible boom as the plane accelerates before takeoff. Kevin Gore was an Irish merchant seaman with the easy manner of a man accustomed to torture and murder. He was the leader of the Toe Cutter Gang, who, under the direction of the horrendously corrupt New South Wales detective Fred Cray, would set upon armed robbers and demand to know the whereabouts of their loot. And the painter and docker Stephen Nitties and a few mates had pulled off a heist in an armoured van in Sydney in 1971. 2 days later, Nitty found himself in the company of Kevin Gore and the Toe Cutters, being asked some rather tough questions. Wisely, Nitties told them where the cash was hidden before any further unpleasantness, because as he described later, Gore and the Toe Cutters didn't just snip off a pinky toe, bandage you up and send you on your way with a limp. Once that first toe came off, that was pretty much you done and dusted. Long story short, Kevin Gore met a grisly fate that was probably his due and was dispatched with 2 shots point blank to the back of the head and transported to the airport, which at the time was laying the concrete for the east-west runway. So next time you feel that little bump, that boom, as the burner prepares to leap into the sky, say g'day to Kevin Gore for me. I met many dark figures over the journey. Roger Rogerson, Chopper Reed, Graham Henry, Nettie Smith. Rogerson was charming and funny in the way psychopaths often are. I once knocked on the door of Chopper Reed's home, an invited guest, to be greeted by Chopper fresh out of the shower, wrapped only in a towel, the knife wounds, ice pick scars and prison tats making his guts look like a relief map of the Himalayas. And during a 2-hour interview, the convicted drug trafficker and armed robber Graham Henry developed what appeared to me to be an unwanted physical attraction to yours truly, and given his long spells in prison, curtailed only by the kindly intercession of the Rand Government Minister for Corrective Services, Rex Buckets Jackson, it left me feeling a little queasy. There were many others, some that I dare not name, and others that if I did would barely stir a glimmer of acknowledgement. For the most part, crime is like that, largely anonymous, driven by poverty, personality defects and poor choices. Some simply fall into it, and in this dangerous world, seduced by psychopaths, they fall further than they could ever have anticipated. One such fellow, who I will call the driver, fell into the worst possible company, that of Nick the Russian Radev, while doing a short stint in the jug for traffic offences. Radev was an extortionist, a toe cutter in the criminal parlance, and his methods were calculating and brutal. He is, to my mind, the worst and most violent gangster in this country's history. I met the driver when he was fresh out of prison. We agreed to meet in a pub in East St Kilda, a known haunt for crims, as part of my research into Nick the Russian. It was a rough joint, a real rough joint, I tell you. Now look, I know the audience participation, coercion, can be a bit tedious sometimes, but can you humour me on this occasion? So when I say it was a rough joint, I tell you, a real rough joint, you are supposed to reply, how rough was it, Jack? So I'll start again. It was a rough joint, a real rough joint, I tell you. It was so rough. The bistro was serving broken legs of lamb. Now that's an old Rodney Dangerfield joke, and I just had to squeeze it in there. Now the driver proceeded to regale me with anecdotes about his long and awful association with Nick Radev, Rudd insisted that the driver owed him $250,000, and a 10-year-long nightmare then unfolded for the driver, a nightmare that only ended when Rudd was shot dead in Melbourne's gang wars. It was said that when the violent pimp, extortionist and murderer John Stuart Regan, known as the magician for his freakish ability to make people disappear, including that ba-boom on the east-west tarmac, Kevin Gore, when the magician was shot dead in Marrickville in 1971, a cheer resounded from behind the walls of Long Bay Jail. And when Rudd was shot dead in Coburg within cooey of the old Pentridge prison, you could hear champagne corks popping all over Melbourne. Now, Chow Hayes used to say that the measure of a man was the number of people who attended his funeral. It is as good a measure as any. Disappointingly for Chow, his funeral in 1994 was attended by a motley crew, no more than a dozen people. And at Rudd's funeral, replete with a $50,000 gold casket, the ultimate dead gangster accoutrement, there was not one person in attendance. And if there is a moral to this story, it is that crime doesn't pay, but you can save a few bob on the catering. Well, thank you very much.
Jack the Insider writes a regular blog on the Australian's website. Melanie Tate is the producer and host of Now Hear This on RN. We've collaborated on many storytelling events. I invited Melanie onto the couch on stage to ask her how she faked her way to success in London's West End.
Well, it may not appear really very obvious to you now, but I wanted to be a musical theatre star. Like Elaine Page or Julie Andrews or somebody like that.
Which one of us can honestly say we haven't wanted to be Julie Andrews once in our lives? I certainly have. So whereabouts were you actually working, though, Mel, when you got there?
I had the worst job. It was so awful. I was working at this place called the Merchant Navy Hotel. It was pretty much the most depressing hotel in all of London. And, like, the clientele, they would just sit at their tables and have their tea, and that was it. And it was a very depressing, non-inspiring... Like, I didn't want to go and do song and dance.
So what was your social life like while this was going on?
Oh, gosh. My social life was so sad. I'd get about one Saturday night off every month, and I would just want to go and spend time with this beautiful bunch of friends of mine.
And there was a guy?
Yeah.
A beautiful guy?
Oh, he was so beautiful. I can't even... Like a movie star good looking. And just between us, I had never even patched anybody. I hadn't... Yeah, oh. I know. How sweet... It's kind of sweet, isn't it? But it's actually... It was. I was obsessed with it. I was obsessed with... Because, you know, if you haven't patched somebody, you haven't, you know, probably... Well, I was a virgin. I'm just going to say it right now. So I was obsessed...
Wasn't that nice? You were waiting for the patch before going to the next step.
I'm a nice girl. What can I say? So I had
you want to be Julie Andrews, yes.
Yeah.
So did he ask you out on a date or did you ask him on a date?
No, he asked me.
Oh.
And he got on the phone one day and he said, "Hey, Mel, do you know that pub around the corner from your hotel? They've got a trivia night on a Wednesday night and I kind of think you'd be good at trivia." Fantastic, let's go. So I was very excited about this. I went out and I got my hair blow dried and I bought a new coat and I was so excited and I just waited at my hotel for him to come. Just waited.
How long did you wait?
I waited all night because he never showed. I was pretty sad.
And what were you like by the time you gave up hope?
Well, I had decided very young not to cry over boys through past experience. You know, I'd grown up in a country town as a little chubby girl, and that's kind of tough in terms of boyfriends. So I was just like, you know, I will do what I know how to do to get through this. And I wrote a really nasty monologue about this dumb guy who was always banging girls, who, you know, had nothing else to his life but banging girls and, you know, just terrible.
And that was supposed to be him?
Yeah, that was him. It was completely him. I even gave him the same job. You know, I really just went to town that night with this monologue because I fancied myself as a bit of a secret... I was a bit of a secret writer as well.
Yeah, it reminds me of a friend, a comedian I knew called Pete McCarthy, who wanted to get rid of a flatmate, so he started up a band that used to rehearse a song called Move Out Colin. So you got your revenge through art.
I did.
And what did this monologue turn into over time?
Well, the monologue amazingly turned into this play called The Vegemite Tales. And how it became The Vegemite Tales was I had my hours between each shift where I would write. And I was so povo that I would write on, like restaurant chits, you know, that you take orders on, and I would write in notebooks. And eventually I sort of gathered together a story about this young virgin who goes to visit a house of 28 to 30-year-olds. And one of the 28 to 30-year-olds is in love with her and obsessed with taking her virginity. So basically I got this play called The Vegemite Tales, which was all about Aussies living in London.
So what was this play? Was it a kind of imagined fantasy of the way you wanted the world to be, or a kind of a savage, brutal attack on this dreadful man who stood you up?
Well, you know what? It was a brutal attack to begin with, but by the end of the play, of course, they had fallen in love romantic comedy style.
And so when did you actually decide, having written this, to put it on, try and put it on the
stage? Well, I gave it to one of the other boys in the house to read, and bless him, he said, "This is great, you should put it on."
Oh, that's nice.
Isn't that lovely? Because there was a character that was based on him, and he didn't seem, he didn't seem to think that the boy that I loved would care too much. Well, we actually never discussed that aspect of it, but he said, "Yeah, you should put it on."
And how did you cast for actors?
Well, this is the thing. Everything we did was just so unprofessional because, like I said, I just didn't know anything about theatre. So
you were faking it.
We were totally faking it. I just put an ad on a fledgling website called tntmagazine.com, like a little ad, actors wanted here. And I cast pretty much everybody that got in touch. everyone that answered, "You get a role, you get a part, you get a part."
And sets? Who did the sets?
Sets. Oh, this is sad. So have I told you that lovely boy's name was Matt yet? Have I done that?
No.
His name was Matt. Oh my gosh, he's totally going to listen to this, isn't he? And who knows what will happen. Anyway, so he and I just bumped into each other on the street one day when I was going to visit their house. And this was, you know, months after I'd written the play. There's actually a couch, a two-seater couch that was a perfect size for this tiny little stage we had. And Matt, he picked up the couch for me and took all the stuff to the stage.
Oh, okay.
In a play where he was made out to be a moron. Yeah.
Okay, so you put tickets out for sale. How did ticket sales go?
Oh my gosh, it was so fantastic. We got a quarter page ad in TNT.
Vegemite Tales.
Yeah, Vegemite Tales. And we didn't have permission from Vegemite, nothing. Like, we were just a mess. And it sold out. Before we even opened, it was completely sold out.
Are Australians like that?
Yeah.
They'll go, "There's something called Vegemite Tales." I'm going to hand over hard-earned cash and go and see it. So you sold out?
Yeah, before we'd even opened.
It worked?
It worked.
How long did it run for?
It ran eventually for 7 years, with the last 2 years on the West End.
So you would have made quite a bit of money out of that.
Oh, my God, I made so much money.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, don't worry, I spent it all on travel and booze and gentlemen. So I, you know, by the time I came to get a mortgage when I moved back to Australia, I had none of it left but a really great credit rating.
And a first pash by the sound of things too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, thank God.
Thank God.
I actually fell in love for the first time during that first scene, so I did have an actual lovely pash with somebody who was really nice. The stage manager of the first... Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. It was like, it was wonderful. Oh, my God.
So as you were pashing him, did you think, "Cop that, Matt"?
Well, Matt came to opening night with his new girlfriend, and I was all in love with the stage manager, and we were just like two ships passing in the night, like, hey, how are you going? Yeah.
Did Matt know that Captain Dickhead on the stage was based on him?
Yes, he did, because the character's name was Dan, you know, which is the same as Matt, really.
Yeah. So that's how you faked your way onto the London stage.
Yes.
It all worked, it all came true. But just finally, did anyone ever explain why Matt did not show up on date night?
So I was sitting waiting at home because that's what they do in romantic comedies, don't they? They wait to be picked up. He was sitting at the bar waiting for me. Oh, we found out about it like a few months later. I had the guts to say to one of his friends, and he said, and my friend said, he was there waiting for you. He thinks you're a nightmare.
Too. So you stood him up. And then you wrote a toxic play about him.
Yeah. That's
and he was there for you all along.
He was. Isn't that sad?
Melanie Tate, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
Melanie Tate, presenter of The Evening Show on 936 ABC Hobart. And Now Hear This on RN. We were so delighted in our little conversations office when Mark Colvin agreed to tell a story that night. Mark Colvin is the regular host of PM, ABC Radio's current affairs program. He's off at the moment, writing his memoir and back on PM at the beginning of February. Mark's a hugely experienced journalist and a big influence on me as an interviewer. Mark began life in radio on the newly formed 2JJ way back when. As a foreign correspondent, he reported on the American hostage crisis in Tehran and the rise of solidarity in Poland. The life of a foreign correspondent is not without risk, and while covering the massacre in Rwanda in 1994, Mark contracted a rare blood disease which nearly killed him. The progress of the disease eventually required him to have a kidney transplant. And just before Mark began his story, well, he surprised us all with what he had to say about the person who had just preceded him on stage.
Thank you, Richard. Richard has lured me here under false pretenses. I did not know who I'd have to be following. I only have four prosthetic joints. By the way, I have a little secret to impart to you before I even begin about Mel, another little bit of faking it of hers. She left her halo behind. Melanie has three kidneys, and she came to visit me in hospital and she offered me one of them, and she really meant it, and she went through the tests, and for complicated technical reasons it was not possible, but she offered me a kidney. So give it up one more time for Melanie Tate. So tonight I'm going to tell you a story about a naive young man. It's the summer of 1972. I am 20 years old. The place is the large and echoing dining room of the British Embassy in Ulaanbaatar, Outer Mongolia. I'm at the table with my father, Britain's ambassador to what is then effectively a Soviet satellite state, and my stepmother. I don't know it at the time, but my father is not a conventional diplomat. He is an intelligence officer, a senior member of the Secret Intelligence Service, as it prefers to call itself, but which is better known as MI6. He's been made an ambassador, a rarity, because the British Foreign Office does not like to give this highest of all covers to the spooks in its midst, but he's been given it because of a massive potential shift in the Cold War. China is deep in the terrifying throes of the Cultural Revolution, which has turned society on its head and encouraged children to become fanatics who denounce their own parents and have them sent to re-education camps or executed as bourgeois lackeys. The Soviet Union is believed to be deeply concerned about this turmoil to its east, a resurgence of extremism that threatens to out-Stalin Stalin. There's even the fear that the two communist giants, both nuclear-armed, might go to war. So Ulaanbaatar, right between the two, is the key listening post at this almost forgotten turning point in history. By now, I've been staying in the British Embassy for a week or so. I've been warned that walls have ears. I've been told the story about how every year the debuggers, tech heads from London, come and remove all the hidden microphones and wires. Then, predictably, within days, a team from the Ulaanbaatar Central Heating Department turns up. Always in the middle of summer, by the way. Declaring that they've detected a fault and they need to service the radiators. This means dismantling them entirely and reinstalling them, including removal and replacement of half the plaster in the walls. of course. I can also see with my own eyes that the embassy's phone lines aren't connected to the nearest telegraph pole. They all go through the large-ish, windowless brick sentry post just outside the compound. Why on earth would that be? Well, at the time, I'm a long-haired, completely unworldly university student with no political interests or journalistic, fixated on 17th-century English literature, rock and roll, and a largely unreciprocated interest in girls. I had had a pash, but that was probably about it. So I haven't really let these bugging warnings bother me too much, except to notice that my father only ever really opens up when we're waist-deep in cold water trout fishing, which we do most afternoons about 30 kilometres drive out of town. There, he talks freely about all kinds of things, including the fact, and I've never seen this published anywhere, so you're probably hearing it for the first time, that one of his predecessors as British ambassador to Outer Mongolia was so obsessed by the bugging that he went mad, imagining that cameras were following him everywhere, even on long walks on the Mongolian steppe, so mad that he had to be recalled to England. But tonight is the evening when the reality really sinks in. My father, astonishingly, wants to talk shop in the dining room. And he doesn't want a conversation either. He motions me and my stepmother to silence, leans back in his chair at the head of the table, and begins to talk very loudly to the ceiling. He's very angry, he says, almost more angry than he can express. And Her Majesty's government is angry too. Diplomatic bags have arrived that week from London on a plane via Moscow, and they've been tampered with. The wax seals have been broken, the padlocks have been smashed, and the contents have been rifled. Now, I happen to know that this is not in itself a deeply serious security breach. All the really sensitive material comes in by land across China, guarded every minute of the way by diplomatic couriers called Queen's Messengers. I know this because that's how I arrived here myself, with two of those couriers, on the train from Beijing. But I'm just smart enough to keep my mouth shut about that, because my father is talking about a point of principle. Diplomatic bags of any kind are sacrosanct under the Vienna Conventions, and what the Mongolians, or maybe the Russians, have done is a casual insult at best, and at worst, a deliberate provocation. All these points my father makes loudly to the ceiling, while saying that his repeated protests to the Foreign Ministry have been blandly ignored day after day. Now he says he's had enough. He's decided to cable London tomorrow morning, recommending that they begin proceedings to break off diplomatic relations with Outer Mongolia, close the embassy, and return him and the family home. That would be huge, as big a diplomatic breach as they come, enough to make headlines from the Washington Post to Pravda. It's quite a speech, probably about 10 minutes long, and delivered with exceptional vehemence. It takes real effort, when he gives us the sign that it's all over, to resume the charade of normal dinner table conversation. This would have been about 9 o'clock of a Thursday evening. At 8 the next morning, there's an obsequious phone call from the Mongolian Foreign Ministry. They're sending an official car to collect the ambassador for a face-to-face meeting with the minister, who would like to apologise profusely for an incident which has only just been brought to his personal attention and which should never have happened. As I say, I didn't then know that my father was actually a spy. That kind of bugging was normal for conventional diplomats in every embassy, every residence, every staff flat, and often every car in every country where the KGB and its sister organisations like the Stasi reigned supreme. But when he did tell me, much later in the 70s, that story came back to me, and I still think of it with the realisation that he lived for decades like that, bluffing and being bluffed to, listening and being listened to, always trying to work out what was real and what was fake, and how you could turn it or its opposite to your advantage. Inevitably, it spills into your private life and it affects your family. It certainly cured me of any ambitions to be James Bond. In fact, looking back, it may have fed into a certain obsession with trying to tell the truth straight with no mirrors or refracting lenses. But some say the only really good stories are the ones you tell against yourself. So I'll end still on that Mongolian trip with the story of my first great missed scoop. I arrived in Ulaanbaatar, as I've mentioned, by train. It was a journey that involved a midnight stop at a border post called Erlian. I was drinking green tea in a hut on the platform when a member of the People's Liberation Army sat down next to me and asked if he could practice his English. Sure, I said, and we talked about how he was here in this remote border post, but his wife was way over in the east in Shanghai. I remember that. And how I was going to visit my father, who I hadn't seen for 2 years. And then he started talking to me about someone called Lin Biao. It didn't really mean much to me because I was, as I say, completely naive and apolitical and had at the time no journalistic ambitions at all. So he explained to me that Lin Biao had been a marshal in the People's Liberation Army, very close to Mao, and that in September the previous year, 1971, he'd boarded a plane and taken off to defect to Moscow, but that the invincible forces of the Chinese Air Force had shot him down and thereby prevented a potential Russian coup. Oh, I thought, that's interesting, but I didn't really know enough to ask any more penetrating questions. And besides, I thought, if a junior soldier is telling some travelling student this story, it must be common knowledge. He must have read it in the party propaganda sheets. So when my father met me and the Queen's messengers at the station the next day, I didn't mention it to him straight away. We had an awful lot of personal catching up to do, and it just wasn't at the top of my mind. In fact, it didn't come up for about 2 days. And when I did tell him, as a throwaway anecdote, I was shocked at his furious reaction. It was not common knowledge at all. It was the first ever Chinese account of the circumstances, or their version of it, of Lin Biao's death. And I had clearly been meant to pass it on. How did he know this? Because in the last 12 hours, in a couple of other ambiguous encounters, the Chinese had let it be known that this was their official version. But my dilettante attitude had seen him beaten to the intelligence scoop of the year, possibly the decade, by a whole 36 hours. I know I've missed a few big stories since, maybe they're for another day, but I've kept that one hidden away in a little embarrassment-filled box until tonight. You're the first to hear it. However many times people call me a credible journalist, somewhere deep down, I always think I'm faking it.
Mark Colvin is the host of PM on ABC Radio. Mark's father passed away some years ago and Mark wrote an extraordinary obituary with his dad, which was printed in Britain's Daily Telegraph newspaper. I'm really hoping he'll write a book about it one day. Our final speaker was Paul Carter. Paul is a former oil rig worker. We've had him on as a guest several times now. And coincidentally, the last time he was on was to talk about his disturbing discovery that his father had been a spy for MI6 too. And he and Mark Colvin had plenty of stories to share at the end of the night about mysterious fathers who come and go and never quite reveal what they're on about. Paul Carter is the author of several best-selling books, including Don't Tell Mum I Work on the Rigs, She Thinks I'm a Piano Player in a Whorehouse. And a bit of a language warning before he starts because, well, he worked on an oil rig, didn't he, where people tend to have a fairly blunt conversational style.
It's 1999. I worked on the rigs. And back when the rigs were more of a bash now, questions later kind of industry. This is before mandatory drug testing. This is when safety simply consisted of things like don't put your finger where you wouldn't put your dick. Hi-Viz had not been invented yet. That's just the way it was. So I'd been working in the sovereign island state, Brunei. I'd been there for 3 years. I hadn't been home for Christmas in almost 10 years or seen my family. Not that we were close. You know, Dad was running around battering people for Her Majesty's government, and my mother was a reclusive shut-in. So I was dead keen on getting home for a nice, happy, violent family Christmas. Now, so it's 1999, and I was on a jack-up rig in the South China Sea off Vung Tau, Vietnam. And you know when you start your 28 days on, it's 28 days on, 28 days off, you can figure out pretty quickly whether or not you're going to be home for Christmas. And I knew straight away that I wasn't, again. So I'm there, and it's the millennium, it's a big deal, and I'm in love with a girl at the time, and her family had great parties. You know, really good parties with great food and lots of fun, and everyone's missing it. There's 80 guys on the rig. They're all beyond pissed off. But I'd done so many awful things. And so I was in a bad mental state. And you get ambivalent. And I just wanted a bit of family time and Christmas at home. And life at that stage in my life was literally the worst things you can imagine a bunch of recently paroled and or ex-military nutters are going to do when they're in a third world country having too much fun. And I was determined to change all that and had fallen in love. And I wanted to be home for Christmas. I had plans. So all of a sudden the rig manager turned around, the company man on the rig said, they did some testing, there was nothing going on, we're going to plug and abandon the well, everybody go home. Just like that. So there's this mad panic to get off the rig. And we're a day away from Christmas Eve. So it's all about the fist fights that ensue to try and get on a chopper to get off the rig in the first place. Then catch a commercial airliner to Singapore and then go wherever you came from. So I blagged my way straight onto the first chopper. Got to Vung Tau, caught a commercial airliner to Singapore, Changi Airport. And it's still the same today. Changi Airport in Singapore, you just can't muck about with the girls there at the SQ desk. Airline Nazis, they've heard every story, they've seen everything. And I had to try and blag my way onto a flight to Kingsford Smith to come to Sydney, to come home. I had to do it. So I got to the airport, every flight with every carrier through every class was fully booked. First, business, the lot, it was gone. There was no way I was going to get on a flight to Sydney. So I thought, I'm going to have to bullshit my way onto this plane. And there was a couple of flights left to go, so I puckered myself up. I had a large whiskey. I went to the sushi bar and I ordered California rolls and I got the little wasabi little packet with the green with the sauce and I smashed it up my nose. Right? Two sachets up each nostril while I'm in the queue. You know, come and tell us your problem. And there's a whole bunch of people freaking out about getting home for Christmas, and I just shoved two full wasabi sachets up my nose. And the immediate, wow, that's instantaneous. You know, there are tears and flushed cheeks and crying, veins are popping out everywhere, and this poker-faced woman's like, and I'm there going, my wife, I'm not married, obviously. She's having our first baby. I launch into this just Oscar-winning load of bullshit about babies and complications, and I have to get back, and I'm just bawling in front of and she's just, you wait one moment. She comes out the back and she bought it. I did it. She bumped some poor dude out of business class. I got my seat on the plane and it's canapes and I'll have another glass. I'm in the business class toilet with the Q-tips. Oh. I didn't have any adenoids anyway. It doesn't matter. So it's great. I'm going to make it. I'm going home. I couldn't tell anybody I was coming home, but I was excited about it. We landed in Sydney. My elaborate lie had escalated beyond anything I thought would happen. And as we arrive and land, I'm approached by the business class cabin attendant. And she says, some ground crew are here and they want to speak to you. And I panicked. Immediately, I panicked. I was a little bit drunk. And I thought, oh, my God, they checked. They've rang my employers, and they know that I'm not married and that my wife that I don't have is having my non-existent baby. And they're going to demote me from platinum was 15 years crew changing with Singapore Airlines to get my card. They're going to demote me to the green entry-level card, which doesn't mean anything. And this nice man appears and goes, "Hello, Mr. Carter." I'm like, "Oh, are you the airline Nazis? Are you going to take me out in the tarmac and give me a flogging?" And he said to me, "Follow me." And so I leap out of my seat. We didn't have a crew change with check-in luggage. You've just got a bag with some filthy Polaroids and dirty underwear in it. So I grab my bag and I follow this man out of the aircraft. And we're going to fast-track you through the immigration queue. And we're going to fast-track you through the checky, scanny, are you smuggling drugs queue. And we've got a car standing by to rush your lying ass. Yeah. To which maternity hospital is your wife in? And I said, she's at Ranwick, drop one, Ranwick Maternity Hospital. And he's like, "Right." This is, yeah, pre-mobile phone, they're pre-everything. So it's like, right, he's got two-way radio. Oh, roger that, we're off to the Ranwick Women's Hospital. And I'm running behind this lovely man, Singapore Airlines man, and I fake it and tell him I'm absolutely busting and that the lavish business class toilet couldn't comply with my requirements and that I've got to go and drop one now. Okay, wait one, he's going to the toilet. Desperately looking for a payphone. Desperate for a payphone. And there's a payphone. It's not in the loo, it's near the loo, and I make the call. I call the girlfriend who's waiting outside and would go, "Hi," and that would be awkward now, wouldn't it? So I ring her landline in the vain and pathetic hope that somehow her mother can relay a message to her in the arrivals hall at Kingsford Smith, and it's just munted, like, what? Just on the off chance if she calls, tell her to go to Ranwick Women's Hospital and not to approach me. And mother's very confused at this point. And then I follow my friend, and I'm digging out baseball caps. I'm trying to disguise myself. And we run, and there's a car, and she sees me. We ping each other, and she's going... She's giving it the "I'm so in love and I'm 19" wave thing, and I ran away from her with this dude. I'm like, get in the car, drive! It's like we've done a bank job. He's like, "Oh, okay." Girlfriend chasing behind the car. Drive! I was ready to throttle him with the knee up in the back of the seat. We get to Ranwick Women's Hospital and debus out of this car. And we're standing out the front, and he leaps out in because of all the drama and runs to the boot. I've got my bag. I'm thinking, why is he going to the boot? He pops the boot and pulls out this gigantic hamper. Full of nappies and bottles and dummies and rattles and... He goes, let's go. What floor is she on? And I had to get rid of this bastard immediately. Luckily for me, I had some extra wasabi sachets in my pocket. So I feigned a sort of semi-collapse in gratitude, shoving more wasabi up my nose, and then said, "I need to do this on my own." And he went, "I understand." The whole time I'm looking over his shoulder at girlfriend who's standing there with her hands on her hips, looking really confused. Just like that. And he left. He left in his Mercedes. I'm waving. Do I get points for this? And he left. I explained to her what I'd done. She said, "Well done, champ." And we went inside and, we gave the basket to... I asked the lady at reception, "Is there anybody here that hasn't got a giant basket full of nappies?" And they said, "There's dozens." I said, "Right, dish this out to the girls. I'm going home for Christmas." Thank you.
Paul Carter now works in the oil and gas business. He's the author of several best-selling books, including This Is Not a Drill and Ride Like Hell and You'll Get There. Finally, the fabulous Krista Hughes came on stage on the night and performed her own distinctive version of Toxic, a song that was originally recorded by Britney Spears, of all people. Krista Hughes knocked us out on the night with this true version of a fake song.
"Oh, baby, can't you see? I'm calling A guy like you should wear a warning. You're dangerous and I'm falling. It's getting late, I just can't wait. I need a hit, oh baby give me it. You're dangerous and I'm loving it. Too high, can't come down. You got me spinning around and around. Oh baby, baby, can you hear me now? With the taste of your lips, I'm on a high. You're toxic, I'm slipping under. With the taste of a poison paradise, I'm addicted to you. And don't you know that you're toxic?
That is the fabulous Krista Hughes, ending our Christmas Conversations event at Giant Dwarf that was held at the end of last year. Thanks again to our guests, Jill Hicks, Jack the Insider, Melanie Tate, Mark Colvin, and Paul Carter. We recorded a new Christmas Conversations night just last week, stories of bad behaviour, and you'll be hearing those early next year. I'm Richard Feidler. abc.net.au/conversations is our website. My thanks to producers Pam O'Brien, Michelle Ransom-Hughes, Jenna Coda, and of course, to you for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.